Committee and opened the public hearing. We have with us this morning the folks from PERS, Mr. Cleary, and we're going to be talking about the Public Employees Retirement System, the report on the 2004 preliminary earnings crediting. We have Anne-Marie Housley helping us as committee staff this morning, Dallas Wine as the LFO staff. Anything for the good of the order before we begin, sir?
No, just Madam Chair, according to ORS, I'll let you know that before the PERS, Public Employees Retirement System Board, makes a final creditings decision on earnings for the year, it is required by law to come forward to the legislature for its review and comment. So in the during the interim, they come to the emergency board. Otherwise, they come to Ways and Means. So the board has adopted preliminary earnings crediting. It was a decision made back in February, I believe, and the board is scheduled for a meeting at the end of this month. So that they had, and they're here to report.
Good. Against that backdrop, if you would introduce yourselves for the record and spell any unusual spellings of last names, and we will begin. Mr. Cleary, good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, Executive Director of the Public Employee Retirement System. That's Cleary, clear with Y. When I was over in Dublin visiting my daughter last spring, they told me I had the right last name, but once they heard the accent, the price went up. So, and with me this morning is Steve Roadman, who's the administrator of our policy planning and legal analysis division. We used to call them the policy planning legal analysis group which resulted in an acronym called PLAGUE. But it ended up kind of causing people some concern when we said, well, we've got to send that to the plague before we can deal with it. So, but now it's a division, and that's Steve Roadman, R-O-D-E-M-A-N. Madam Chair, we had presented a report back on February 25th to the co-chairs, and you'd received a copy of that. And we'll start with that one.
That's the one with three holes.
It's got the three-hole punch in it. And we'll start with that. But we also wanted to update you with information from a small event that occurred last Tuesday, and that was the Supreme Court's ruling in one of our major litigations, known as the Strunk ruling. Regarding our reform legislation. But if I could, just for to kind of set the stage on earnings crediting, start with that February 25th memo and flip to the first chart, which would be, I think, page 4. It's known, it looks like attachment A up at the top. And what I do is just walk you through, again, this is 2004 figures, where we stood both prior to Strunk and based on what we knew in terms of the 2004 earnings. If you look at that second column, you'll see the balance before crediting for all these different accounts and reserves. And what that represents is the decisions of the board and the earnings up through 2003. So we started at the end of 2003, we dedicated $726 million into the contingency reserve. And at the same time, if you'll go down about five numbers, we put aside about $432 million in the capital preservation reserve. So there we had a total of about $1.2 billion that were set aside from the earnings in 2003. So now we've got earnings in 2004, and those earnings totaled about, if you look in the third column over preliminary earnings distribution down the last net figure, about $5.7 billion. So that's what we had available to distribute. That represented a return of about 14.5%. On the entire PERS fund. which, you know, you can see we were working off of a fund that had a balance of about $41 billion in it. So what the board does then is they start working with that figure, and they first make decisions as to what do they want to set aside for reserves. And we've got two primary reserves, the contingency reserve and the capital preservation reserve, that are designed to be used to mitigate against risks associated with both adverse legal rulings and adverse capital markets. And I think you could say that at least this board's philosophy has been one of reserving whenever they had the opportunity and the reason, and now potentially because of the Strunk ruling, using those reserves whenever they've got a need, a legitimate need. So we started the year again with about $1.2 billion we had in reserves. We had money available. And so the board initially back in February said, we're going to take the maximum amount again to put into the contingency reserve, 7.5% of all earnings, and you'll see that represents about $373 million. And they also signaled that they're going to take some money or possibly put aside some additional money in the capital preservation reserve, but they wanted to get feedback from the various stakeholder groups, and they also wanted to assess whether there'd be any dramatic changes in the landscape, if you will, between February 25th and March 29th when they make their decision. Now, we've had a rather dramatic change in the landscape, but for the capital preservation reserve, they wanted to show you if they didn't take any additional monies to put in the capital preservation reserve, or if they took up to 7.5%. So that's the difference between these two charts. You'll see that what we're talking about reserving in this period for 2004 is a total of somewhere around $650 million additional. And if I rounded my numbers right, I think if the board were to go to the maximum on the or what they signaled would be their maximum on the capital preservation reserve, another 7.5%, we would then have in reserve about $1.8 billion. And my sense is that given the opportunity, given the reason, and now given the need, you might see the board lean pretty heavily towards going to the maximum in the capital preservation reserve as well. So then when we get the numbers finalized as to the impact of the Strunk ruling, they'll then be in a position to see how they can most strategically apply those reserves to mitigate any adverse impact of that. So that kind of gives you the numbers and the setting prior to the Strunk ruling. We did want to then update those as quickly as possible, and so that as a result of that, we've provided a new memo dated March 14th to this committee and to the chair. And what you see in that is again the numbers being very much the same, but the effect of the Strunk ruling, and that being that we have to credit 8% for 2003, our earlier figures did not represent that because under the law prior to Tuesday, we were still in a deficit situation in 2003. We didn't credit anything to those accounts, so we had to credit another about $556 million for 2003, and then there's a roll-up cost associated with that for 2004. It's about an additional $600 million. So we now have shown you kind of those new figures. The first chart, again, shows the previous report. The next chart in the text that we've got shows what would happen if we, or what will happen now that we have to credit 8% for 2003 as well as 8% for 2004. I'm on the second page of that memo, and I draw your attention to the third line there, Tier 1 member regular accounts, and these numbers are rounded, so they're a little bit slightly different than what you saw in the charts. But we start with $6,950,000 in Tier 1 member regular accounts, and this is covering regular accounts for, I believe, somewhere around 103,000 Tier 1 members. And those are both active and inactive members. When we credit the 8% for 2003, roll that up for 2004, and then credit another 8%, we're now looking at adding about $1,156,000,000 to those Tier 1 accounts, and the projected balance now jumps to $8.1 billion, as opposed to what we showed earlier of about 7.5. And the effect of that is, instead of us zeroing out our deficit reserve, if you look at the second line right up above it, you'll see now that we project a deficit of $516 million for the Tier 1 deficit. Again, this is the board, because of the reserves that they've established separate from this, the upwards of $1.8 billion. They will be looking at how do they most strategically apply that, and it could be that that would be one area where we'd zero that out as well going forward. So we wanted to kind of show you the effect. Again, the rest of the numbers don't really change. It's all in that Tier 1 regular account arena. And I might ask Steve if he has got any additional comments on that, or Steve, cover that okay, and if there's questions on the crediting and how it got affected by the Strunk ruling, I'd be happy to take those now, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any absence of questions?
The next thing that we've got, and it's again attached to our March 14th memo, is a question and answer on employer rates, 2005-2007 employer rates. And Dallas had indicated that the committee had some questions as to how we were employing both smoothing for our asset side as well as our liability side. And if you'll turn to the page 2 of that Q&A, you'll see a chart right at the top that shows the asset smoothing formula that we utilize. And what we do is we use a 4-year weighted average to smooth both losses and gains. And so you'll see for the rates that we set in 2005, that'll become effective July 1, 2005, it's based on our valuation, which was up through December 31st, 2003. There's always a lag time because we've got to complete the books and then do this valuation. And so we use a 4-year period. We'll use 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003. And you can see that 4-year period includes 3 years that, from an investment standpoint, certainly weren't stellar, indeed created much of the problem that we've been dealing with over the last 3 years, and that was we dug one heck of a big hole with those investment losses. You'll see here with a combination of both the investment losses and the crediting that occurred as well. So you'll see that for this rate setting period, again, we use those 4 years, 2000 through 2003, we're recognizing 100% of the 2003 earnings. Now, you'd look at that and you'd say to yourself, well, that looks like you didn't really lose money. You got a return of 0.63%. But from an actuarial standpoint and from our formula, we assume 8% earnings. So in the parentheses down below, you'll see kind of what we actually are saying, that we went in the hole about 7.9% for 2003. In 2001, we're pulling in 75% of those losses, and you've got both the market percentage loss as well as the actuarial percentage loss. For 2002, we're pulling in 50%. 2003, we're only recognizing now 25% of those good earnings. So going forward, if we stay above this line, and particularly staying above 8%, we'll eventually start pulling that into the rate base, and that'll be to the positive side of the equation, both for the employers as well as the members.
Mr. Cleary, I'm going to interrupt you and just ask you, for people that may be listening to this in the audience or electronically, what we're really talking about is the determination of future employer contribution rates. And I think the fact that it came as somewhat of a surprise to employers, given the PERS adjustments and now given the ruling, that the rate is still so high. And that's what you're attempting to explain now.
Right.
And I was just trying to put it in nomenclature that differed slightly from smoothing, because I think different legislators in the building are being asked by local government members, what happened? Where are the anticipated savings that were so widely discussed, and why is it that our rates have not dropped?
Madam Chair, of course, that's a good question, and particularly where it comes from, people understood that the reform had savings associated with it. They also understood that we had several good investment years recently, and they're wondering why the combination of those two things hasn't resulted either in either rates staying the same or rates actually dropping. And the key point is we're still filling this hole that we dug in that three-year period, and that was one heck of a big hole. I think liability side, it was around $5 million market value and about $15 million in actuarial value is the hole that we dug. Now, billion, right. big difference, billion, right. When you dig that kind of a hole, the idea of the asset smoothing was that we wouldn't recognize it in the rates immediately. We'd smooth it in over time. So instead of the rates going up dramatically in 2001, they pretty much stayed at the 10%. Now we're starting to recognize all of those losses in our formula. The reform legislation, what it did, first, and I think the legislature recognized this, the quickest way out of a hole is first quit digging. And so the reform legislation helped us quit digging in a number of different areas. Now, some of that has been modified by the Strunk ruling, but there's still significant portions that are still intact and allow us to quit digging in those areas. And then we got to fill it back in. And we're filling it back in with both good earnings as well as changes in employer rates. Now, you might remember, Senator and members of the committee, that prior to the reform legislation, we were predicting that rates would go up this for 2005 up in the 25% of payroll area and possibly even higher. And right now, we're looking at rates in the 18 to 19% average when we phase that all in. So you still have got significant savings associated with the reform legislation. Is it where we'd like it? No. Historically, we were in the 10%, 10 to 12% range. And I think long term, if we continue to perform as the actuary assumes, and we get through digging this hole, we'll start seeing the rates moderate back down.
One, of course, unknown is market performance over both the near short term as well as projecting out. We've been rewarded by a good market recently as the economy seems to be turning around. Talk a little bit about what the downside is of a bad market performance in the short term.
Well, Madam Chair, it depends on what your definition of the short term is. If we're talking 2005, the rates that we've got right now are set based on the system valuation up through December of 2003. So they don't reflect the good earnings that we had in 2004. So we've got a little bit of a cushion there. We earned about 14.5%. We assume 8%, so we've got a little bit of a cushion there. 2005, we would we'd hope that, you know, again, we continue to come in at the assumed rate. We've got some sensitivity tests, and we wanted to be able to share them with you. We had some projections of rates at both 6% earning to show you kind of a less than our assumed rate, and a 10% earning, and so you can see how those rates would vary it in that within that band. Unfortunately, those were all based on the pre-Strunk ruling, so we want to update those. And when we come back in front of the committee, we'll have that available and share that with you. Because you can see that if we long-term, if we perform less than 8%, we're going to have trouble again. It's this short-term volatility that particularly the smoothing was designed to offset the impacts of that.
That's a perfect segue into the one other point that I'd like to get on the record, and that is, I think some of my colleagues and I certainly have had calls from constituents saying, why is it that we should suffer for PERS bad investment decisions? Would you share with the audience, whoever they are that are listening to this hearing, how investments are made on behalf of PERS?
Madam Chair, the investments are handled of the PERS fund as well as all the other large state funds. My prior job at State Lands, the Common School Fund we administered, but the investments of that as well as the PERS fund are handled by the Oregon Investment Council and staffed by State Treasury. Now, you know, I think I'd probably challenge poor investment decisions, because that fund has done extremely well and very competitive compared nationwide. And from a they just had a peer review of it, and I believe the findings were that they were very much a high value, low cost investment strategy.
Let me correct myself, because I don't want to leave the impression that I'm critical of the investments. Having just seen Treasury's budget in this committee, I think we're aware of their performance. But what I was translating into was the constituent concern about the legislature did reforms, rates continue to be high, people are suffering as a result of the high rates, whether at the bargaining table or wherever.
Right.
And in retrospectively, folks saying, who's to blame for this? And I'm asking you in layman's terms to explain both the investment philosophy and how investments are done on behalf of PERS, as well as you already have, to try to explain this smoothing and the fact that we had in 2000, 2001, 2002, very poor performance.
Very poor performance.
But I was not
right.
implying any criticism of the Treasury's investments.
And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And I guess I would point out that what we had during that time period was an unprecedented decline in the market since the Great Depression. We've not seen anything like that. And investors, whether you had investment in your own personal 401 type account or anything else, you were looking at basically close to 50% declines for some people in market value associated with that that poor performance. You know, I asked staff to put together the earnings that this fund has had since we got into a diversified portfolio, and I believe it was 1969 when we started investing in equities. And our 35-year average since 1969 was a return of slightly more than 11%. Now, again, volatility in there. You'll have these type of years, but long-term, slightly more than 11%. I look at it from kind of a hydrologist view. I say, well, what's that mean in terms of what can you guarantee me 6 out of every 10 years? Our what we call a 60% exceedance, is between 7.5% and 9%. So, you know, that's again a pretty good performing fund, but there are no guarantees associated with our investment, and that's why every 2 years the board and the actuary look at what we call our assumed earnings rate assumption, and we test that. and we test that against both with advice from both the Oregon Investment Council's investment advisors, looking at other national trends and looking at what's going on in other systems as well. And we just recently tested it, and the board agreed that we would stick with the 8% assumed earnings for this next 2-year period. But we'll test that again. And that is not, that's not something fixed in statute. That is something that the board can adjust over time.
How often does your board meet?
Madam Chair, we meet monthly, sometimes more often than that, but generally we're meeting on a monthly basis. And you know, this is the new board, the post-reform board. Again, probably one of the major changes out of the reform legislation. It's now a 5-member board, 3 of them from the private sector, and the 3 that we've got, you know, bring substantial experience from both financial, human resource, pension administration experience, as well as legal experience. They can't have any personal interest in PERS benefits, so they're basically totally disconnected, if you will. The other 2 members, one of them it represents the membership, has to be a public employee, and in this case it's a school teacher down from the Eugene area, and then one represents a public employer. In this case, who's also a member, and that's Brenda Rockland, the president of SAFE. But, you know, I think that what people are going to see is, of course, they saw a different attitude with this board, and one of it is in the area that we came here to talk with you today about, and that is in reserving. And this board has been very aggressive, if you will, in terms of saying if we've got the opportunity and we've got the reason, we're going to establish these reserves, because they've had experience with this volatility, and I think they've got a much better appreciation for the fact that if you don't save during the good years, you're not going to have it during the bad years. And given the risks that we're exposed to, again, both litigation-wise and market-wise, that seems to have been a very solid strategy.
That's a strategy that could be employed by others within your listening area.
Others within my listening area, and even others in different career areas. We used to try to employ that strategy in the water world, because you knew that those wet years were going to be followed by dry years.
Any questions from the committee?
So, Madam Chair, that kind of concludes what we came before you today to share with you. Again, we will be, the board will meet on the 29th. By then, we'll have a report on the financial implications associated with the Strunk ruling, and that will, I'm sure, be part of their consideration as they look at whether they want to max out their reserves again this time. I think the wisdom of their reserving decisions will be borne out. There's a number of other things that we're looking at in terms of implementation of the Strunk litigation, and some of those are things that we're going to be talking with our LFO staff, because it looks like we've got some of the work that we did in the past year or so we're going to have to do over again. We've got to do a number of different calculations, because when you go back in and credit accounts back in 2003, that plays into the amount of money that would otherwise been available for people when they retire, when they withdraw, when there's a death, when there's a divorce. There's a number of different things, and we're just now working on those statistics, but we hope to have all that information for our board by the 29th. And we certainly will share copies with you as well, because we may be back in front of you, Madam Chair, to talk a little bit about modifying our budget proposal a little bit.
Well, and I was just going to open the door to do that, given that there are going to be staffing pressures in your shop and member expectations about how quickly you'll be able to perform all the calculations that you need to perform. I see Dallas nodding, which is comforting to me, but I want to make sure that the door is open for you to come in and make the committee and through the committee the rest of the Ways and Means process and the rest of the legislature aware of what needs your agency is going to have in dealing with the ramifications of the ruling.
We appreciate that, Madam Chair, and we would point out that there's still one additional major case in front of the Supreme Court, and that is their review of the City of Eugene versus the Board decision, also known as the Lipscomb decision. That likewise could have effects on our calculations, and one of the things that we're going to talk with our board about, and we're going to have to talk with our members and our employers, whether or not it makes some sense to really wait until, if you will, the other shoe falls, before we expend a lot of time starting to do recalculations. We want to do them right, and we want to do them quickly, but we don't want to have to do them over three times if we can avoid that. And I think if we can work with the members and their understanding that eventually they're going to get everything that they're entitled to, hopefully they'll understand that, you know, at this stage it's more important for us to get this right than it is to get it quick.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that approach. Senator Morissette.
When do you anticipate the court making that decision?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, it used to be when do you anticipate the Strunk decision. I didn't have a good idea on that. We would hope that it would come out pretty quickly. They indicated throughout the Strunk ruling, they footnoted to that, but I can't tell you whether it'll be, you know, a week, a month, or 2 months or so, but we would, again, I think they understand the interrelation of those two. And
Mr. Clay, since the decision came, I have been in several different venues where different folks have soldiered through an explanation of the ramifications of what the Supreme Court did, and I think in all but a couple of those venues, the Lipscomb case has not been discussed in much detail. I don't know whether your office has prepared or is contemplating preparing a very high-level summary of the Supreme Court ruling, as well as any other issues that the legislature should be cognizant of. And I'm not asking for a detailed treatise. I'm just asking for a little one-pager that those of us who are back in our districts doing town halls could have, and the question inevitably comes up, could have a little crib sheet to know this is in some bullets what the court did, this is the effect, and these are the unknowns that we still have. I think that the legislature would be very appreciative of that kind of a high-level summary.
Madam Chair, I'd be appreciative of it as well, because I get asked a lot of the same questions, and I think that's exactly what we'll work towards. We'll have to develop a detailed report for our board for March 29th, but then we'll take that and we'll distill that down, so we can share that information with you in that manner.
Good.
And I appreciate the one-page idea as well.
Thank you. I would entertain any questions. We've been joined by Co-Chair Scott, and we're going to close the public hearing and go into a work session now that he's here to constitute a quorum, also joined by Representative Smith. Any questions of the committee? All right. Well, then I am going to close the public hearing on the Public Employees Retirement System Report on the 2004 Preliminary Earnings Crediting and open a work session on the Public Employees Retirement System Report on the 2004 Preliminary Earnings Crediting Report. And I would entertain a motion
to acknowledge receipt of the report and recommend the full of the committee.
Okay. Representative Smith moves acknowledging the report and moving the report to the
full acknowledgement.
Moving the acknowledgement of the report to the full Ways and Means Committee. And do we want to do a roll call vote or just are there any objections?
I think Ways and Means you have to do a roll call.
No.
Okay, then without objection, we will accept the report and move it to the full Ways and Means with a do accept recommendation.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else to come before the committee? Thank Co-Chair Scott for joining us this morning to constitute the quorum. And in the absence of any questions, I will close the work session. And we have somebody who... Nope. Okay. Close the work session, and is there any other business to come before the committee this morning?
Not business, but Madam Chair, members, nothing scheduled for tomorrow. However, Wednesday and Thursday, you'll have phase one with the Secretary of State's office. The binders, we just received them last week, so we'll get them out to you this afternoon. And the co-chairs have approved to put it.
Did we receive the binders for the Secretary of State?
Oh, maybe you have. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You did get them? Okay. Someone was ahead of you. Monica was.
And I have one other announcement. So we have nothing. We will not meet tomorrow.
That is correct.
Okay. The one other announcement is that on Friday during the chairs meeting with the co-chairs, a very detailed memorandum for phase two was distributed, and it is my understanding from the co-chairs that that will be moving to all of the members of Ways and Means shortly so that you will have the opportunity to see what is contemplated in phase two, and also some very detailed instructions from the co-chairs about how they expect the committees to proceed through the phase two review of the budgets. And so if you find that you don't come into receipt of that, is it today?
I believe they're supposed to distribute it today.
You can either contact the chair or you could contact Dallas, and we'll make sure that you get a copy of it. Any other comments from the committee? Without objection, then we are adjourned.
Thank you, ma'am.